Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. This is our anniversary of the Civil War that began in 1861. I think that I've said this here before, that over the next 4 years, we're going to see a lot erupting around the Civil War. One of those books that was has been written about the Civil War, and as people have asked him before, why with 70,000 books on the Civil War do we need any more? Because there are probably new things to unearth and new ways to look at this this war that really was a war that changed America. That is 1776, that is 9/11, that is all these things wrapped up into this war that identifies America. Adam Goodhart works at Washington College in Chestertown, where he is the Hodson Trust Griswold Director of Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience, a professor of history, and his book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening. And Adam, good to meet you.
Mark, great to meet you.
So this book, when you start reading it, clearly you have Union sympathies.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I actually talk in the prologue about how, you know, it's easy for us to sort of accept today that there was a right side and a wrong side in a war like World War II, but I think it's much harder for us to accept the fact that there were hundreds of thousands of Americans who fought and died for a cause that was wrong, and a cause that I do think was evil, the Confederate cause. Now, I need to back off because people are already screaming at their radios and yes, and say that, you know, I have a lot of people as I go around and talk about this book who say, well, my great-grandfather fought for the Confederacy. And are you saying that he was evil? He wasn't thinking about slavery when he went off to fight. And I do think that we have to draw a distinction between the cause and the people. You know, wars tend to have a sort of a momentum and a gravitational pull of their own, and they draw people in for many different reasons. If we think about wars in our own times, people go off and fight in Iraq and Afghanistan not always because they strongly believe in our specific policies in those countries, but often out of a more generalized sense of patriotism, of wanting to serve their country, of wanting to defend the country somehow. And I think that's how it was for a lot of people with the Confederacy and also with the Union. I don't think that everyone who went off and fought for the Union cause was thinking about slavery either. And in fact, one of the things that I really wanted to do with this book was to get past these, you know, these stark black and white debates over, was the Civil War about slavery or was it about Union? Which side stood for what? And talk about just the varieties of human experience that happen at a moment in history like that.
But it was a couple of things from what you said. But first, let me just say that, I mean, when we look at the Civil War, we always see the swashbuckling heroes of the Civil War as being like mostly the Confederate guerrilla warrior and all the, you know, the guerrilla and all the Confederate soldiers. And even in our Westerns on television, it's the old Confederate veteran who goes out west and becomes this tough individualist who goes to the plains. So the heroes that we come out of the Civil War with are always Confederate heroes. And what you've done here is to rebirth, so to speak, a number of swashbuckling heroes from the north.
Yeah, the Northerners definitely knew how to buckle a good swash as well as anybody else, and that is one of the things that I try to restore to them. You know, at the time, I think it would have been very surprising to people in 1865, right at the end of the war, for anyone to say, well, the Southern side really had all of the glory and all of the glamour as we think of it today, because there were a great number of Union heroes, very dashing Union heroes, in fact, who are largely forgotten. And I think that has a lot to do, and this is something that we can come back to if you want, but with the sort of post-war politics, the politics of the past 146 years since the end of the war, 46 yeah. years since the end of the war, and with how, you know, the South lost the war, and so there was this sort of tacit agreement to allow them to actually have the glory. Sort of, okay, well, you guys lost the actual war. We'll let you sort of keep the mystique of the war. And I think that has to do with this, the Gone with the Wind phenomenon.
You are building mystique in this book in many ways, but I mean, mystique based on fact and history. And you talked about slavery and what was the real underpinning of the war. And it's, it's complex. And I think that you have this kind of this when you have this quote from Whitman that the Negro is not the chief thing; the chief thing was to stick together. So, when I read that quote and read other parts of the book, it made me think that when we see this debate taking place, and I'll see if you agree or disagree with this from your looking at the history, that slavery, the war was about slavery because states' rights was about slavery in the South and maintaining slavery. For the slaves, it was about slavery.
Of course.
But for Lincoln and many of the Northerners, who may have not liked slavery necessarily, it was about the crime of secession and keeping the Union together, the spirit that America could have a new revolution to save America.
Yeah,
is that complex?
It was really, you know, it was about slavery and not about slavery at the same time. It's interesting when that quote from Whitman, where he says it was the Negro was not the chief thing; the chief thing was to stick together. He's talking about a very specific moment after the attack on Fort Sumter, when people weren't thinking about the deep underlying causes of the war. They were thinking about that moment when their nation had just been assaulted. We can think of Pearl Harbor or 9/11 as more recent moments like that. But, you know, it's interesting that even as he's denying that it was about slavery, he also mentions the Negro in that same sentence. So the Negro is still there. It's still present. And I think that's very telling because, you know, we can say that the war was about holding the Union together primarily for the North, but the fact is that if it had simply been about holding the Union together at any price, the North would have been ready to compromise with the South to somehow enshrine slavery within the Constitution so that it would be inviolable legally for all eternity. But in fact, millions of Americans at that moment, especially in the North, were standing up and saying, enough is enough. We're not ready to continue granting concession after concession to what they called the slave power, as had been done, in fact, in America for generations ever since the framing of the Constitution. And so it was a moment in which really keeping the Union together at any price was not the goal. The goal was to keep the Union together while also upholding this ideal of liberty that many people thought was in danger of being lost.
Because as you quote over and over again in the book, Abraham Lincoln, who was, as you write, was much criticized in the beginning of his administration as not knowing what the hell he was doing and being a do-nothing president.
And I think those critiques are well-founded to some degree.
was clear that for him, secession was a crime. And it was a blow against democracy and a blow against the future of democracy and freedom.
That's right. And I think it's, you know, it's hard really to argue that it was anything else from the perspective of today or even really from the perspective of 1861. I mean, when we think about the very foundations of democratic government, really chief among everything is the idea of majority rule. And majority rule also means that in order for majority rule to work, the minority has to acquiesce to that majority. And, you know, we've seen time and again around the world in other countries how when the minority does not acquiesce, almost immediately things tumble over into anarchy and then quickly into authoritarianism. When there's a contested election in which the minority refuses to give up power, that's always when these coups occur, when you end up with a dictator. And I think that Lincoln realized that unless the minority was ready to acquiesce, minority meaning the Southerners, meaning the supporters of Lincoln's opponents, were ready to acquiesce to the results of the presidential election that elected Lincoln. And if they simply said, well, we're going to sort of take our cookies and go home, then there would be nothing to prevent any other group from doing the same thing anytime right. there was a vote, whether in Congress or a national election, that they disagreed with. And so I think Lincoln realized that secession was anarchy, and secession also in a real sense was a sort of an authoritarianism, almost an authoritarian form of terrorism against the democratic system.
We're talking with Adam Goodhart. His book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening, focusing on this first year of the Civil War, the lives of some very powerfully interesting people. And part of what you focus on here in the beginning of the book, and I mean, when I was reading the book, it's written like David Simon does Treme or The Wire, because you go from place to place and really way back again. And
I love that comparison.
Which I like. But you open up by talking about the attack on Fort Sumter that we say in our historical minds was the beginning of the Civil War was not really the beginning of the Civil War. And you talk about Anderson, who's the commander, sit down and and even the baseball man Abner Doubleday.
That's right.
So,
yeah, well, you know, we tend to think of the Civil War as being precipitated by this Southern rebellion, which in a sense it was, but there was really a Northern revolution, as I call it, or not even just the North, because it also included many Southern Unionists, and of course it included millions of African American Southerners
and
folks even out west in California. Exactly. I bring California into the Civil War in a big way. I think
I fell
it hasn't really
Jesse
been.
Fremont. We'll get to her later.
Oh yeah, let's definitely talk about Jesse. But there was this sort of Northern. The North was ready to take a stand in 1860 in a way that it hadn't been before. People were ready to draw a line in the sand to say, enough is enough. We're not going to yield another inch to the slaveholders. And I pick out a moment, as you say, to begin my book that I see as sort of symbolic of this whole thing. It's several months before Fort Sumter. We're in Charleston Harbor, and this little Union garrison is there in an old, crumbling Revolutionary War era fort called Fort Moultrie. And the commander is this guy named Robert Anderson. He's a Kentuckian, comes from a slaveholding background.
Doesn't like Lincoln.
Doesn't like Lincoln at all, but feels very strongly about preserving the Union. And he realizes that if he's there with this little force of 60 soldiers and a brass band, you know, there in Charleston Harbor in this crumbling old fort, he is not going to be able to hold on to this. It'll be a great sort of symbolic defeat for the Union, that there in the center, the epicenter of secession, Charleston, South Carolina, this fort has fallen. And so in the middle of the night, he packs up his men in a few boats, and they stealthily row across the channel in Charleston Harbor, and they occupy Fort Sumter. And in the morning, all of Charleston, the secessionists, wake up, and they see the Stars and Stripes flying over Fort Sumter, and they realize that they've been sort of rooked by
hoodwinked.
This guy. Yeah, exactly, hoodwinked by this guy they thought they were about to force to surrender to them. And in fact, the secessionists just start howling that this has inaugurated civil war. And this is 4 months before the assault on Sumter by the Confederates began. And I do think that there was something to it, something to the idea that this act of, you might say, Northern aggression or Northern activism was really what launched the war.
In some ways, the response of Abraham Lincoln to this particular act, the way you write it, it was almost as if he schemed to say, okay, I'm not going to attack. I'm going to let them attack first, which would rally the nation, which it did.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Lincoln coming into this secession crisis, or really coming to the presidency from Springfield, Illinois, he was seen by a lot of people as a rube, as this sort of backwoods hick. They called him an ape. I mean, he was coming in with just about the lowest estimation among any American.
He stayed quiet for the 4 months with all this was going in. He didn't say a word.
He basically stayed quiet for almost a year from the moment that he was nominated for the presidency in the spring of 1861 by the Republican in 1860 by the Republicans, all the way up to when he took office in March of 1861. And you know, this was the greatest crisis the United States had ever faced. And here's this guy sitting mum in Springfield, Illinois. Finally starts to speak on his trip to Washington, and he gives these speeches that are just bumbling, stumbling, really nonsensical speeches where he says, well, this national crisis, it's really not that much of a problem. Nobody's been hurt yet. Nobody is suffering. And this is as the nation is falling apart. So people aren't expecting very much of Lincoln. And in fact, when he gets to Washington, he's sort of paralyzed by this crisis at Fort Sumter, where he has to decide the food is running out. The time is running out for this little Union garrison in Charleston Harbor. He has to decide whether he's going to withdraw them and suffer this great symbolic loss in the eyes of the nation and the world and show that he's really willing to yield to Southern threats? Or is he going to reinforce or resupply this little garrison and thus have it taken as an act of aggression against the South? And so he's really, he feels trapped, but then Lincoln steps up and sort of becomes in that moment the brilliant strategist that we think of him as later in the war. He turns the tables on Jefferson Davis, and he puts Jefferson Davis into a trap. And the way that he does that is he says, instead of sending a military mission down to Charleston Harbor, to Fort Sumter, I'm going to send unarmed boats into the harbor, delivering food supplies, couched as a humanitarian mission. He even says something that no commander-in-chief, no experienced military commander would have done. he decides to telegraph the Confederates and let them know that this resupply mission is coming. What he does by that is brilliant. He forces the South into a situation where either they have to back down and allow this resupply mission in, or they have to be put in the position of opening fire against the Union forces and opening the Civil War themselves. And that's exactly what they do. So it was a great strategic victory for Lincoln. In fact, afterwards, he said, Fort Sumter fell, and in doing so did more service to us than it ever could have otherwise.
We're talking with Adam Goodhart. 1861 is his book about the beginning of the Civil War, The Civil War Awakened. So Fort Sumter is attacked, and even the Northerners who could care less about slavery erupted in this kind of patriotic fervor as Pearl Harbor in 1941 or September 11th, 2011. America just erupted in this patriotic fervor.
Yeah.
And the picture you have here of in the book of the thousands and thousands of New Yorkers.
Yeah, 500,000, some people said.
Jammed the streets of Manhattan then.
Yes.
In 1861.
And amazingly, you know, they gathered in Union Square, which of course is the same spot where people gathered. It became the focal point of the gatherings in 2001 after the attacks on
2001.
Yeah,
right.
September 11th
September
attacks.
11,
yeah, exactly.
Right.
And
a lot of ones here: 61, 41,
yeah,
2001.
And there's a picture in my book of the George Washington statue that still stands in Union Square. Stood in Union Square then, and in 1861, they placed the soot-stained and torn flag of Fort Sumter in the arms of George Washington. And in 2001, people gathered around that same statue, and listeners may remember, lit votive candles and put posters and flowers there about their missing loved ones. So there are all these eerie resonances with the present. But yeah, one of the resonances that I really felt was it was a moment, as you say, like Pearl Harbor, like 9/11, when all of the political divisions of this deeply ambivalent nation were sort of erased almost literally in an instant. America in 1861, early 1861, people were very divided, vehemently divided over whether or not to compromise with the South, over how to try to save the Union or whether to even try to save the Union. And in that flash, in that flash of light of the exploding first shell at Fort Sumter, these ambivalences dissolved, much as in 2001. People were very ambivalent, as you'll recall, about the Bush administration, this president who had taken office
right.
with this very contested election. And yet, suddenly, overnight, the guy had, I forget, a 96% approval rating or something like that. So it was one of those moments in American history that things changed overnight. And I think part of the reason I wrote the book was that I felt a very strong personal pull from having experienced the events of 10 years ago. It gave me a sort of a strong personal attraction, in a sense, to what happened 150 years ago.
But when this thing happened in New York, people wanted to volunteer and go fight to save the Union.
Yeah, the recruiting stations are mobbed.
Mobbed, but Lincoln didn't want to build an army.
That's right.
He wasn't ready. He wasn't even prepared at all.
Yeah. Yeah, the U.S. Army at this point, I mean, the entire federal government was so tiny at this moment in history. I mean, if you went to D.C. in 1861, it was like going to the equivalent of, you know, a sleepy little county seat. Today, you could literally just sort of wander into the White House and practically knock on the president's office door and request an appointment just to chat with him about anything that was on your mind. And so it was this tiny little federal bureaucracy. The entire War Department had a few dozen employees. The entire U.S. Army was a few thousand men, mostly stationed out in the Indian territories of the Far West. So they really, for one thing, they weren't ready to handle this gigantic military mobilization that was required. And for another thing, you know, Lincoln really felt, and I think this was actually a great miscalculation, strategic miscalculation on his part. He still thought that the South could be sort of half coerced and half coaxed back into the Union with a sort of a carrot and stick approach. He still thought they would come to their senses. Of course, they weren't going to. And so at this moment when literally I think over a million men would have been ready to enlist to go off and fight the South, he only takes 75,000.
So let's take this. Let's tell the story. You're in New York. And you have this great piece in here about how Americans have always been very ambivalent about war, whether it was the Revolutionary War they were ambivalent about, this war, Vietnam, whatever war. Americans
always
don't necessarily want to go to war.
No. And yet there's an attraction to it as well.
But Americans, as you put in here, what's really interesting to me, because it makes me think of the streets and how we criticize kids in the streets, today is that Americans are brawlers.
Yep.
They like a fight.
Yep.
They like watching a fight. They like being in a fight.
Yep.
They like getting to a bar and getting into a fist fight.
Yep.
It's part of that de Tocqueville saw this
yeah.
American ethos for some reason.
Yep. Yeah, and in fact, I talk about this one particular regiment of New York City firemen who are just like the meanest, bruisingest, brawling guys in the entire United States of America. I mean, these real kind of Bowery street toughs who enlist and form an all-fireman regiment called the New York Fire Zouaves.
Zouaves. It's very funny, just a digression. As a kid, being an analyst of war, you had this book about the uniforms, remember?
Oh, yeah, remember sure. Yeah, yeah. They've got the best uniforms.
They had these uniforms. Who are these guys? These red shirts, these balloon yeah. pants?
They look like, they were uniforms taken from Algerian warriors. You know, it would never pass muster today, of course,
right.
because, yeah, very politically suspect. These guys wearing fezes and these sort of, you know, North African baggy pants going into battle. But yeah, I mean, these guys were ready to fight because they fought on a regular basis. They fought against other fire companies. But, you know, talking about that idea of fighting in American culture, another thing that I think about the Civil War, and it's something that actually didn't even get all that much into my book, but I've thought about since then, is that our whole culture in America, our political culture, is a culture of struggle, a culture of contest, battle. You know, we use these military metaphors to talk about politics. Even, you know, a campaign. Campaign is a word that comes from war.
Right.
We talk about standing up, fighting for what we believe in, being ready to sacrifice our lives for our country. This is the rhetoric of our democracy. And so, in a sense, we're constantly in America, even in peacetime, being primed to go off and fight. And I think that's actually, you know, part of the reason that we still have this fascination with the Civil War 150 years later is that our politics constantly feels like we're on the brink of tipping over into actual Civil War, actual blood in the streets instead of just rhetorical blood in the streets. And 1861 was the moment that did happen.
But here's an unlikely hero who became a real hero in America, Elmer Ellsworth.
Yeah.
We talked about Anderson, who became a big hero because of Fort Sumter. People loved him. He was this, you know, they wanted to get a lock of his hair.
Exactly.
Women were crazy about this man who this Fort Sumter. But then comes along, and even the name, I mean, Elmer Ellsworth.
Isn't that great? They don't make him like that anymore. Yeah, a great 19th century name. And he was, you know, largely forgotten today, but basically a rock star in 1860, 1861. He was this guy who came out of nowhere, this poor, starving clerk in an office in Chicago, was a sort of a natural at military prowess, sort of in the same way that somebody today might be a natural at playing basketball or baseball. He was a natural at this form of military training, military drill called the Zouave drill, which involved, it was like a cross between SEAL Team 6 and the Cirque du Soleil, basically, in 1860, 1861. These guys who stood up there and at a moment when people were used to thinking of soldiers marching very four square and stiff into battle, these Zouaves would jump and leap and twirl their bayonets around and do somersaults on the battlefield. And so Ellsworth, first he took this group of Zouave cadets on a tour of the United States the summer before the Civil War began. They performed on the White House lawn for President Buchanan. They just were acclaimed as these sort of great heroes of popular culture. Then at the beginning of the war, he organizes these firemen from New York into a regiment of Zouaves, takes them across the Potomac into Virginia in the first wave of the Union offensive into the Confederacy, and he's killed sort of literally in the first minutes of the Civil War in Virginia and becomes the Union's first great hero and martyr. It's one of these stories that's sort of truth is better than fiction.
It's an amazing story, and he was killed by this literally a bar owner.
Yeah.
Because he went to take the Confederate flag down from the roof of this building, stormed to this place, and then comes out and says, this guy's with a shotgun, shoots him, and then the soldier runs his sword through the bar keep. And now the plaque remembers the barkeep as defending his private property, but doesn't name Elmer Ellsworth anywhere.
Yeah, it's this incredibly, it's a tragic but also really sort of squalid moment, because here they are, this Elmer Ellsworth, this great American hero, the embodiment of Northern martial prowess, and he falls not on some glorious battlefield, but in a squalid sort of double homicide on the stairway of this cheap hotel in Alexandria, Virginia. And this is a man who also has been like a son to Abraham Lincoln.
He hung out with Lincoln and his
wife.
Oh,
God, he was practically a member of the family. Yeah, and Lincoln mourned this death. And, you know, it's important. America mourned the death. But, you know, it's important to remember that, you know, Lincoln, among all of the 30 million Americans, basically all of whom would end up suffering personal losses in this terrible war to come, Lincoln was one of the very first to suffer a terrible personal family loss. I think that's important to remember about Lincoln and how he entered in upon this terrible struggle.
The personalization of this war that you wrote and kind of the things you pulled in, I think, were very important. I think that one of the things before we jump into Missouri, which we have to talk about, and General Benjamin Butler that we have to talk about, and John and Jesse Fremont, and Thomas Starr King, and we have to get these characters. One of the things is that you convey in this book to me is how the unsettling moment this time was in, because we always look at history from way up here and down on something that we don't get the feel and sense of the complete dislocation America was in at the moment,
The
madhouse that it was at the time.
It was a dislocation, but, it was also a moment of great excitement. And this is a place where I really found a lot of echoes of the 1960s in America, in the 1860s. It was a time of great uncertainty, of great fear, and yet also a time of huge optimism at the same time, a sense that things were changing and they might change in terrible ways, but that the country might be remade for the better as well. I found even before the actual fighting began, just these remarks by Americans living in the late 1850s, really, and saying that this is a moment. I found a quote by a woman, a young female college student in this little town in northwest Ohio.
She
says the very air at that moment, looking back, felt charged with an electric shock. There were these innovations going on in science. Darwinism was just coming into the fore. All of these inventions, the telegraph that put people in touch with the rest of the world with an immediacy that they had never had before, this
like
huge
now.
Boom in media. And
like now.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to overdo it with,
the
analogies,
it was
a moment of great explosion in communications and in mass culture. And so it was a moment when people felt that that anything was possible, both for better and for worse.
We're talking with Adam Goodhart, a professor at Washington College in Chestertown, who's written this book that was on the front page of the New York Times Review of Books Sunday, that comes out on Sundays. It's really taken the country. He's joining us here in our studios. The book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening, and we'll be right back with Adam Goodhart, so don't go away. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're talking with Adam Goodhart, whose book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening. Adam Goodhart is the Hodson Trust Griswold Director of Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience on the Eastern Shore here. This book has been acclaimed by the New York Times and many places across the country, an amazing study of the beginning of the Civil War, that first year of 1861, hence the name. There's some things that just popped out of me that I never knew, and I love history. I mean, I never thought about Garfield,
who became James
president.
Garfield.
James Garfield becomes president, assassinated, only president for 4 months. So he's a blip.
Poor Garfield.
He's a blip. You don't think about him.
Yeah.
But he's not a blip.
He's one of those guys, he's sometimes, they're sometimes called the Smith Brothers presidents. They're all these sort of dreary guys with big Victorian bushy beards.
Right.
Indistinguishable guys. But I actually, this is sort of a quirk of mine as a historian, as a writer, is I have a thing for little-known presidents. I think nobody gets to be president of the United States sort of by accident. They're almost all extraordinary people in their own way. And Garfield was definitely one. I picked him. We don't associate Garfield with the Civil War. He didn't become president until 20 years later in 1881. But I picked him at that moment of the dawning of the Civil War. He was a young man living in he was 29 years old. He's living in Ohio. He's a college professor in a very small college, small town in northwest Ohio. And he's this sort of obscure state legislator. But I took him as just an example of what an ambitious, politically aware young American was thinking and feeling and experiencing in the years just before the Civil War and then as the war began. And it's wonderful studying a president because when a president leaves the White House or is killed in the White House, in Garfield's case, especially when they're assassinated, nobody throws away a single scrap of paper that person ever wrote or indeed touched. And so you go to the Library of Congress today, and you can basically step inside James Garfield's mind through this enormous, enormous collection of papers that the librarians told me I'm basically the only one who ever went and looked.
That's
very rare that people look at this collection. But he saved every scrap of paper going back to when he was a teenager. And so to try to read the mind of someone at that Civil War moment, you really can't do better than James Garfield, a very conflicted young man, a very idealistic young man in some ways, a very pragmatic young man, and sort almost cynically ambitious and pragmatic in other ways. And, you know, in other words, he's a sort of a bundle of complexities and contradictions, just as each one of us is today. And so I like delving into these characters who are very ambiguous.
But he became somebody who supported Lincoln, was almost a fanatic anti-slavery Republican.
That's right. Yeah, he went from being, you know, in a way mirroring much of the North. He went from being very sort of lukewarm about slavery and abolition, really to the point of being scornful of abolitionists just a few years before the war, to suddenly, right before the war began, he becomes passionately anti-slavery. He becomes passionately pro-Lincoln, and he's ready to go off and fight in this war. And in fact, hours after the attack on Fort Sumter, he foresees that this war may well cost 1 million American lives. It ended up costing somewhat more than half of a million American lives, but he's ready to fight it. So that transformation within James Garfield is in some ways a microcosm of the transformation within the entire North.
And one of the most moving things I never knew about him was in the afterword or the epilogue of your book, when you put in parts of his inauguration speech, where half of it was about, even this is after Reconstruction, was about the Negro people of America.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Yeah, this is 20 years after the war and at a very sort of cynical moment in American history when the victory of the war and its implications for black Americans has to a large degree been forgotten, pushed aside. 4 years earlier, Rutherford Hayes, Garfield's predecessor as president, has called an end to Reconstruction, ended this process of the federal government trying to enforce black rights in the South. And so Garfield stands there, 1881, on the steps of the Capitol to take the oath of office. Standing next to him is Rutherford Hayes, his predecessor who dismantled Reconstruction. And Garfield gives this incredible inaugural address, almost forgotten, of course, today, in which he spends most of the address, as no other American president has ever done in over 200 years, talking about racial justice. Talking about racial justice at this moment of a nadir of racial justice in America. And he says that the freedom of the slaves was the greatest event in American history since the signing of the Constitution. Yet this moment of our country will not be complete until black people are raised to full equality with whites economically, politically, educationally. And there's a remarkable, if I can read for a moment, this remarkable sort of coda to his inaugural address. He talks about, he's looking towards the future, and he talks about how our own little children will soon control the destinies of the Republic. And he says, 50 years hence, our children will not be divided in their opinions concerning our controversies. They will surely bless their fathers and their fathers' God that the Union was preserved, that slavery was overthrown, and that both races were made equal before the law. We may hasten or we may retard, but we cannot prevent the final reconciliation. And that just sort of every time I read that, 1881, and he's imagining that by 1931, the wounds of the Civil War will be healed, the wounds of racial division will be healed in America, and, you know, foreshadowing almost eerily what Martin Luther King would say about the children of the future, black and white, standing up together in the speech, of course, at the other end of the mall in Washington more than 80 years later.
Let me think that there's another one. 1961 was the beginning of the Freedom Rides in the sit-ins. These ones are getting to me.
But anyway, exactly.
But the thing about what Garfield might have done had he not been assassinated.
Yeah, it's hard to say now. And Garfield was a man of many contradictions, of many self-doubts in a way, and sort of pulled this way and that by his idealism and his pragmatism and his self-doubt. So it's hard to say, but I do think that he was a great American idealist who I found just fascinating, endlessly fascinating to study.
So you bring other people to light here. And also, this is something very little talked about in American history when you look at the Civil War. You focus on the West, on Missouri and California, and go back and forth twixt the two because there were connections with the Fremonts, yeah, the two states. But you write about Heinrich Bornstein and these German immigrants, this German community that formed the core of union sympathizers in Missouri. But there were more than sympathizers. These guys were warriors from the streets of Berlin and Paris.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's funny. When we think about the Civil War today, we often think of it as this sort of history that we can visit at a few battlefields in the East, at Gettysburg or Antietam or Chancellorsville. But in fact, this was a war that whose story, at least as I tried to tell it, stretches across the continent and really around the world. It was even perceived at the time as a great event in global history that drew in people from all over the globe. And it also was a war that in very fundamental ways was about the American West. It was about America's future in the West and who would control that future, whether it would be the forces of slavery, of whether the slave system would be allowed to spread or whether it would be contained to within its present bounds. So, yeah, I talk about this contest for the West, and I love that story that you mentioned, Mark, of St. Louis and Missouri. And these German revolutionaries, really, these guys who were these sort of doughty veterans of the nationalist revolts in Europe in 1848.
Socialists, leftists.
They're socialists, yeah. This newspaper calls them red down to their very kidneys. And so they've come to America. They're not about to let these Southern reactionaries take over their state, the slaveholding state of Missouri. And so they basically stage a coup. These German guys stage a coup and more or less seize control of the state government, chase out the pro-secession governor in the southern state before the pro-Confederate forces are able to organize within Missouri. It's a very dramatic story. It's a story that culminates in literally blood in the streets, the kind of civil war, not that we think of being fought sort of on
street fighting.
Yeah, I mean, not fought on these battlefields as we think of the civil war today, but, I mean, a civil war like we're seeing in, you know, Benghazi. Right now, in the
right.
headlines of the moment, where
right.
with civilians getting caught in the crossfire, mothers cradling the corpses of their dead children in the streets, and this is, you know, a couple of months before the Battle of Bull Run.
Matter of fact, you talk about this in terms of these are, as you said, the revolutionaries who fought in the revolutions of 1848 in Europe. This guy ran a newspaper where Karl Marx wrote some of his
yeah.
first work. And
Karl Marx was following the Civil War and commenting on it in
and
Europe.
Wrote about
yeah,
it.
Wrote about it, exactly.
And so, but here you have these guys in Missouri, and around the country, in what you describe as the street fighting. That this year
yeah.
of 1861 was really, in the border states especially, this bare knuckle, killing one another for control. Of what's going to happen in the beginning of the Civil War.
Well, including, you know, we're sitting here in Baltimore and just,
right here.
You know, around the corner practically,
right.
The famous Maryland song, Avenge the Patriotic Gore That Flecked the Streets of Baltimore.
Yeah, we sing Maryland, My Maryland, so it's a state song, we don't realize it's a pro-slavery.
That's right. Please don't make
song.
Me sing it on the air.
No, I'm not going to sing it. I don't sing it anymore.
Okay, good.
but one of the things, this made me think of something else you wrote about, which I think is little talked about in terms of the South, the Confederacy, which is that there was a grand plan by some in the Confederacy to build this new imperial power that would take over the
yeah.
entire Caribbean and world, keep it slaveholding, move into coffee and sugar.
Exactly.
And so this wasn't just simply states' rights we're talking about.
No, and that's, you know, how it tends to be framed from the perspective of today. But really, the rights, the states' rights, in fact, that the Confederates were talking about, very central to that was the right to continue expanding the slave system. And they said repeatedly that our system cannot thrive unless it expands into the lands of the West. And there were also a great many Southern leaders, congressmen, senators, vice presidents of the United States who wanted the system to expand southwards, to gobble up much of Latin America, the Caribbean, to form what they called a golden circle. That some said in 1861 that it would eclipse all the empires of the world, all the glories of ancient Greece and Rome. Once this slave empire encircled the Caribbean, the Gulf of Mexico, and controlled the world's great staple crops of sugar and cotton and others. So really this was about a nation with grand imperial ambitions. Of course, it's only fair to say that the Union side also harbored
ambitions.
Their own imperial ambitions. I don't mean to say it was all on one side.
And part of those imperial ambitions were out west.
Yeah.
And they were with this incredible story of California. We hear about the Republic of California, but the little bits in our history book. But then again, we never talk about the role California played in the Civil War, and John and Jesse Fremont, and these incredible couple and characters.
Yeah, I really fell in love with Jesse Fremont. About everybody who ever met her fell in love with Jesse Fremont. Her husband was the great pathfinder, John C. Fremont, explorer and mapper of the West, and presidential candidate, the Republicans' first presidential candidate, 1856.
Six.
Yeah, exactly.
The beginning of the Republican Party.
Yeah, at which time Jesse was actually more popular with the electorate than her husband was. She was this very, very strong-willed woman, the daughter of one of the great antebellum political leaders, Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri, grew up in a slaveholding family, became staunchly anti-slavery, and just had this sort of...
And he was the son of a born out of wedlock.
Yeah, exactly, to an itinerant French mural painter. I mean, just these sort of wonderfully romantic characters that I found in the course of my research. But Jesse, she had a sort of a magnetism, sort of literally a magnetism that drew people around her. She had this marvelous estate, Black Point, overlooking the San Francisco Bay, and she drew together, I mean, these sort of sea captains and literary figures and politicians, and Herman Melville found his way up there, and Bret Hart, and she had this sort of constant bubbling conversation at this salon in sort of rough and ready Gold Rush San Francisco, at which there was a sort of a Western form of unionism that was cooked up, which, you know, it wasn't at all a foregone conclusion that California would stay with the rest of the country in 1861. A lot of people wanted to break off. They said, to hell with the East and its problems. We'll raise the flag of the Bear Republic and form a new empire on the shores of the Pacific, an empire that looks westward into the South Seas and even across to the shores of Asia. So it was a moment when all these things that seem sort of wild to us today were possible.
And there was a battle going on in California between the people who wanted to be who supported the Confederacy and those who supported the Union. This was not a done deal at all on that level either.
And conspiracies, a conspiracy to seize Alcatraz Island and the munitions depot there and use that to stage a revolt that would break California away from the Union. So there were just wheels within wheels going on.
That's the story of Jesse Fremont and Thomas Starr King and these, you know, who all these people came west to California. Incredible figures. I mean,
Thomas Starr King, who was Jesse Fremont's best friend, who was this very different from her, this little sort of shriveled up, pale tadpole of a Unitarian minister from Massachusetts.
What a star
who comes
he
out,
became.
He did, and he becomes this great orator and a sort of a warrior of words for the Union, and he's called the man who saved California for the Union. California, in fact, went so far as to place his statue in the Capitol Rotunda in Washington, D.C., and just about a year ago, that statue, sad to say, was pulled out and replaced by the state of California with a statue of that other hero, Ronald Reagan. So poor Thomas Starr King, long forgotten and disgraced.
But, he became this orator against slavery and for democracy and for the revolution. And he's...
Yeah, not just that, but sort of the voice of history. And he told his fellow Californians, this is why you belong to the United States of America and why American history belongs to you. He traced this sort of mystical vision of an entire continent that was knit together by geography, the Mississippi River with its great trunk running down the center of the continent and its branches like the branches of a spreading tree, an epic history of peoples passing from the east into the west, sort of from sea to shining sea, as we might say in a later generation, and this sort of idea of union in a very poetic sense that knit the country together. You know, people kind of they grooved to poetry and they vibrated to great words in that time in history in a way that I think it's difficult for us to realize in our era of sort of, well, subverbal popular culture in some ways and certainly a kind of an impoverished rhetoric today. You know, it wasn't simply about great words. It was about the way people responded to them.
And another story that we can't forget about, and I think that it's an amazing story to me, and I've been just fascinated by it. I read it first in the New York Times when you had it in the New York Times, and then it's a big piece of this book. Which is the story of Frank Baker, Sheppard Malloy, James Townsend, and General Benjamin Butler.
Yeah.
And tell us that story.
Yeah, it's when these three young slaves, these three young black Virginians encounter the most sort of unlikely hero of the war, this sort of stout, funny-looking, politically conservative and rather cynical Union Northern politician from Massachusetts, who's just a couple weeks earlier been turned into a Union general. And this moment when these four men collide is the moment of sort of, I see it as almost like a nuclear fission that sets off a chain reaction that ends up
really
tipping slavery towards its end throughout the South. And what happens just in brief is that Butler, the general, is commanding this little Union outpost, isolated Union outpost called Fortress Monroe, the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, surrounded by newly seceded Confederate territory. And just a few weeks into the war, late May of 1861, one night these three slaves escape from the Confederate lines where they've been put to work building fortifications, forcibly conscripted to work on Confederate fortifications, make their way into the Union lines. They're brought before this General Butler, and he has to decide what to do with them. Does he send them back into slavery, or does he give them asylum within the Union fort? And for various reasons, he decides that he's going to give them asylum, that he can't send them back. He needs to come up with a justification for this because, of course, the war at this point is not thought of, including it's not thought of by the Lincoln administration, as a war against slavery. In fact, Lincoln has made it clear we will enforce the fugitive slave laws wherever they are in effect. But Butler says, you know, I can't send these men back who are being used for military purposes by the Confederacy. So, good lawyer that he is in civilian life, he invokes this sort of little-known clause in military law, which is that property being used for military purposes by the enemy can be confiscated as contraband of war. So he says, okay, Confederates, if you say that people can be property, I'm going to confiscate this property just like I would confiscate a shipment of muskets to the Southern forces. So he does this, and predictably enough, within almost literally hours, more and more slaves getting wind of this are flocking to the Union lines. Soon the dozens become hundreds, the hundreds eventually become thousands, and then tens of thousands. And the Lincoln administration is, again, it's also in a difficult position. It doesn't want to do anything that's seen as interfering with slavery, but it also politically can't send these people back into bondage. And so it sets off a chain reaction that really, as I see it, anticipates the Emancipation Proclamation and really creates the momentum that made the Emancipation Proclamation possible.
You're unearthing this story for America that you did in the Times and is also in your book. To me, was one of the most important pieces, because it laid waste to the fact that the idea that slaves of African descent were not actively fighting for their freedom and went over these lines to go to the other side to be free, and how the communication system allowed it. It was also sort of how this guy, Benjamin Butler, this conservative Massachusetts guy, was transformed and even after the war as a fighter for the rights of freed slaves. I mean, this experience transformed him. And many of the men who served with him, who met slaves for the first time in their lives, met black people for the first times in their lives.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, Butler's such an interesting figure because he was, as you say, a conservative. He was in his previous political career. He really sort of made red meat out of race baiting in Massachusetts.
Right.
And yet, you know, I think it's often revolutions are made or at least abetted by these sometimes deeply conservative figures who, for one reason or another, allow revolutions to happen or even precipitate them. Because when a conservative like Butler makes a revolution happen, and he was a Democrat, so an opponent of Lincoln's Republicans, it can be very hard for his fellow conservatives to sort of countermand that. So I really think that this complicated conservative figure made that happen. Of course, he then flips over completely and becomes one of the most radical Republicans who, for decades after the war, continues to fight uncompromisingly for black civil rights.
Which is an amazing story.
Yeah, amazing transformation.
In Louisiana.
Yeah, this, yeah. And when you talk about the way
the white folks in Louisiana think of him as a butcher.
Exactly. Yeah, Beast Butler,
the
they
Beast
call
Butler,
him.
Beast yeah. Butler, they called him.
Yeah.
We're talking with Adam Goodhart, his book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening. So one of the things in concluding this conversation about the war, I mean, you write in the book about this whole July 4th chapter you have, and part of that is 1861, is Abraham Lincoln giving this speech on July 4th and comparing that to the Gettysburg Address and how different they really were, preserving the Union and then ending slavery. But you also talk about how the radical forces really affected the consciousness of America and changed it. To tie that together about in terms of where you think this, what this 1861 did for the Civil War, but also what it says about who we are now in America in 2011.
Well, you know, it was this very interesting moment. I end my book July 4th, 1861, and Lincoln, this very strange president, this great president,
strange
who was also
man.
A very strange,
strange man.
Man. Yeah, for those first months after Fort Sumter, he's more than anything else, he spends his time writing an address, writing a document that he plans to send to Congress on July 4th, symbolically enough. And it's very strange. People wonder, what is the guy doing at this moment? He should be concentrating on mobilizing the military, on working politically. He's literally sort of locked up in his office in the White House, not seeing anybody writing draft after draft of this long document, a document that's, I think, little known by most people who think about Lincoln today, this great message, in which he's sort of, it's a historical document in which he recaps the history of secession. He talks about why secession is anarchy, why secession is an existential threat to not just the Union, not just the United States, but the idea of democracy around the entire world. And he really, in doing that, anticipates what he says in the Gettysburg Address, so that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. He uses almost the same language, actually, in this address. But he also says something else that's really radically new in American politics. He talks about how the highest goal of government in America, of government in a democracy, is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and fair chance in the race of life. I think this is an idea, it's wholly new in American politics and government. It probably would have given most of the founding fathers a rash in the 18th century. It anticipates the New Deal in many ways, a 20th century ideal of government. And Lincoln is realizing that this Civil War moment is a moment not just of preserving things as they were, but a moment of revolution and making the country into something new. And I think in many ways the Union victory in the Civil War did make that possible. And the other thing that it made possible that continues today is a sense that America is not simply about preserving whatever freedoms we seized in 1776 or enshrined in the Constitution in 1787. There's a very real ideal in this country that freedom is something that should be expanding, that it's a never-ending process, and that we are striving towards greater ideals of human rights in our country, and not just in our country, but around the world. And that too is something that I think would have seemed foreign to many people before the Civil War, foreign to some people before the Civil War, but really grew out of it.
Civil War, then, from your perspective, from what you're writing about, is an ongoing breathing revolution that hasn't stopped.
Exactly. Yeah, Lincoln and others called it the Second American Revolution. They called it a new birth of freedom. But in many ways, that new birth of freedom, I think, is something that many Americans in subsequent generations, and I think in our own generation too, have continued striving towards.
We've been talking with Adam Goodhart. His book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening, really well worth the read, very well written, rolls fast, and brings to light an era that we know so little about, and brings to life swashbuckling heroes who fought for freedom in this country. 1861, The Civil War Awakened, Adam Goodhart. Good to meet you. Thank you so much for writing the book and joining us here in our studios today.
Thanks so much for having me, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.